I feel like if kids are raised with parents who have killed their hearts and have subsumed all of their interests and desires in the interest of being quote unquote responsible, what kind of kid are you raising?
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with author, geek culture historian, and award-winning graphic designer Tim Lapatino. In his 20-year career, Tim's consistently been drawn to design and the way it impacts our popular culture. He's obsessed with exploring and understanding the creative process and loves telling the stories of unheralded creative people who work beyond the spotlight. His best-selling design history book, Art of Atari, has sold more than 60,000 copies and been published in English, French, German, and Spanish. Tim is also the editor of Undisputed Street Fighter, a retrospective on the popular video game franchise, and co-author of the design inspiration book, Damn Good, Top Designers Discuss Their All-Time Favorite Projects. His work has been published in more than a dozen books and journals, including the Logo Lounge series and industry classic, Designing Brand Identity. Tim's written for HOW Magazine, Geek Monthly, Retro Gamer, and other publications. Tim is dad to a 7-year-old daughter and 3-year-old son. In this episode, Tim explains how journalism school led him to a career as a self-taught graphic designer and how a blog post in 2012 changed the trajectory of his life and career forever. He also explains how he talked his way into all sorts of design roles he wasn't a perfect fit for, but made work with a combination of tenacity and humility. We talk about the rise of geek culture, the power of pursuing strange passions, and why people pay to see others believe in themselves. Tim also provides an intimate and honest view behind the scenes of his book projects and the impact they have had on his marriage and children. This is a pretty optimistic and inspirational episode, and the reason I saved it for the end of season 3. Thanks so much for being on the show, man. I'm really excited to have you, and I feel like we've been talking around these topics for years now, probably, and it's nice to finally do it intentionally and on the record and have a dedicated conversation.
Totally, totally. Well, I it's stuff worth exploring, so I'm really glad to explore it with you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So for all of the interviews, I've started with the guest's own origin story, you know, to borrow from comic book superheroes. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your dad, your relationship with him or other father figures you might have had.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot about my work and how that has come from my family, from my relationship with my dad, and how those things kind of intertwine. And I think, looking at my dad worked at one company basically his whole career. And, you know, that changes how you think about things, right? You know, he had a career. He went from, factory floor when he was 19, he dropped out of college to become a VP, and he did really well and provided for our family, took care of us, you know, was, you know, sometimes he traveled in different seasons of his career, and in other places he, you know, was home more. But I think that also really colors the way you look at it. My mom also had a career, was a nurse, you know, and both of my parents had careers that were really tied to their jobs. And I think for me, that's a huge change from the way I think of my job. Some of that is me, and some of that is, I think, the era we find ourselves in today, right? You know, 2019, you know, I'm midway career, and the way my career looks is vastly different.
Yeah, I think that's really true, that generational shift. My dad's worked for Delta Airlines his entire life.
Oh, wow.
For him to be somewhere for 40 plus years and with all the intention to retire from that same place, it's just fundamentally different than how we work. You mentioned factory floor. So what industry was your dad in?
So he basically worked for a company that made caps on jars. So the company was called White Cap, and basically they did everything from fabrication to working with big companies like baby food companies, and they would make specific, you know, in the parlance of that industry, they're called closures, right? And they made these caps and they manufacture them, and it was a family-owned company for much of my dad's life and career. It was owned by the White family, and he worked up to the point where he was traveling all over the world, you know, selling these things and meeting with clients, you know, very much like some of the work we do. You know, they were making the stuff, but then they'd manufacture based on client needs. And, you know, I don't know that we've talked so much about this over the years, my dad and I, but it was a job and he, you know, fed his family and, you know, we did well. We went from being, you know, his mom and dad, you know, very blue collar and just kept kind of being upwardly mobile. But it wasn't something that he was so passionate about that he was excited to talk to us about it when he came home from work. You know, and I'm not always excited to talk about work when I come home, but I think it just gets at a different thing, you know, and I'm always very cognizant when I'm saying this because of my privilege, the idea that I want my work to be more than just feeding my family and contributing to the overall economic good. I want it to be something that uses my gifts and maybe even stirs my passions, probably, you know, in that order, but different points of life, those are different things. But, you know, it's such a fundamental different way of thinking about it. You know, I'm willing to make all kinds of different trades to balance those things. Whereas my parents would be like, is it a steady paycheck? Are you getting benefits? Is it secure? And can you retire there? And I think this is interesting. I love my family and they're super awesome and they're generous. They're also a super conventional family. You know, everybody in my family almost, you know, my mom and dad have had those kinds of careers. I have a couple brothers who are teachers and one other brother who's been at a company basically his whole career. And I think that I feel like the odd duck because that is not, one, that's not really the creative industry. And two, that's not me. So, you know, I don't have a lot to commiserate with, you know, in my family because no one does what I do. And so it seems strange. Even the way we go about it is different.
When did that divergence occur? You've got folks and brothers that are setting an example or, you know, living a particular way and thinking about work and career sounds like very different than you. When did that difference expose itself and what was that like?
I mean, I think being the oldest, it was different right off the bat, right? You know, my dad dropped out of college. My mom did go to 4-year nursing school and, you know, at DePaul and was awesome, but she was a commuter student as well. So she commuted, she lived in the city. And so I was the first kid, you know, on our side of the family that went away to college. So that was like super cool. That was what you were going to do. And at first I wanted to go to art school, you know, looked at different art schools. Writing and art were always my passions. And it was always, it's always, even to this day, it's a question of like, how do I mix those two things? So it was either go to art school and do something with that or write and do journalism, you know, and pre-internet, you don't know as much about each of these different careers as you do now. So I, you know, ended up going to the University of Illinois where I thought, oh, I could do both. That turned out to be totally not true. But thank you, my high school guidance counselor. You had one job and you really kind of flubbed it.
Lies.
It totally lies. But, you know, whatever. It's fine. It worked out. You know, I went to J school. And that's a totally different track. And, you know, it's a very interesting one, especially in the mid-90s. There was a very specific way that you went about being a journalist. You went to J school. You went to one of like 3 or 4 schools. You went to University of Illinois or Northwestern or Mizzou or, you know, a couple of other really, really good journalism schools. Mine was one of them. And then you got out and you wrote obituaries for a couple of years. You covered city council meetings and you moved up. The internet's changed all of that. The media landscape's totally different. But at that time, I was like, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to cover city council meetings for 2 years in Podunk, Missouri. So from the very beginning, I was already bucking this idea of there's a certain way to do this and I want to do it. You know, whether I was doing that intentionally or not, a lot of that has to do with my appetite for sort of the unknown. And some of it was just, hey, you know, the culture is changing around you and you just got to adapt.
So were they, your father in particular, supportive of this track you were taking? Like how did his ideas about work, did they influence that?
Yeah. I mean, I think being the first one and also being the first one that goes away to school, I think it automatically puts you in the crosshairs of like, are you going to get a job? Are there good benefits? Are, you know, is it stable? Can you stay there a while? Or is this a fly-by-night thing? That's their rubric. How do we gauge what he wants to do? You know, and I think they were totally worried about the starving artist syndrome. You know, it's like, oh, what are you going to do? You're going to paint? You're going to live on the sidewalk? You know, and so journalism is a much more known quantity. You're like, okay, well, we know there are journalists out there. We see their bylines and we don't know anything about that, but we understand that that's probably better than eating ramen noodles and, you know, making art. You know, and I didn't have a super clear idea what I wanted to do either, but I knew the things that I was good at. And in retrospect, I don't know if I would say that that's good advice, but I think it's important. You know, I think we've gotten to the place where people think education and college is training for a job. And I firmly disagree with that. I think the culture is different now. I think students are much more savvy about what the opportunities are, and that they're much more sort of entrepreneurial about it. But I knew what I was good at, you know, and I focused on those things. So for me in college, it was journalism and, you know, narrative writing and deep diving there, some creative writing. I was able to audit a few design classes, and a lot of my friends were graphic designers. So I learned a lot in that way. And I basically just tried to immerse myself in it. So I was like following, you know, the things that I was interested in, and was able to mash those up into something that would start to be kind of a career.
And so you're in journalism school, but you're getting this supplemental exposure to design. And coming out of that program, when did those two things shift? Because I think of you as a writer and author and in ways a journalist. But first and foremost, to me, you're you know, in my mind, I think of you as a designer and someone who ran their own studio. So like, how long were you a practicing journalist before you said, I gotta really learn this design thing or do more of this design thing?
Yeah, you know, I think the two things were happening in parallel. I mean, I was always in love with this like long form narrative journalism. They're sort of the heroes of the faith, you know, whether you've got Gore Vidal or Woodward and Bernstein, and then you've got these people who, Walt Harrington, who were writing this in the, especially in the, you know, they call it the new journalism. They were writing in the 60s and 70s, this idea that you could write this immersive narrative nonfiction with scenes and characters and pacing, and really take some of the tools of fiction and use them in nonfiction. And that was fascinating to me, but I didn't have a sense that I could do that myself, but I loved it, you know? And so I've got that on one hand. On the other hand, I'm reading, you know, David Carson magazines and analyzing logos and looking at, you know, all that stuff and being really intrigued by it and taking classes. But then, you know, even right up from the beginning, like I worked at the school newspaper for 3 years, you know, in college. But what was I doing? I was doing layout there. And then I was a night editor, which was basically somewhere in between a page editor who figured out what was going to run that night and making sure that writers had their stories in on time, but then also making sure things were laid out well. So it was always this blend. I wrote a column, you know, for a couple of years on comic books, which comes as a surprise to absolutely no one, you know, and I was always interested in pop culture and writing, but also the design side. You know, even in my column, I would pick out the art that I wanted to show. And that was my way of introducing people to things. And I really have this curatorial bone that feels like it runs through my whole personality, as I like to expose people to things they don't know about, but I feel like they should. And so I was exposing, you know, college students to Akira and to manga and Eastman and Laird, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the black and white comics and all this stuff. And so you've got this curation side, and you've got this design side, and you've got this writing side. And I was always trying to like juggle, you know, could I do one or the other? I designed the engineering magazine because our newspaper was part of a media company, and one of the other properties in the company was this engineering magazine. And I happened to bump into these people, and they said, hey, well, we really need a publication designer. Well, I'm 20. I don't know anything. So sure, of course I could do it. And, you know, I designed this engineering magazine for a couple of years, trying to make it something that looked interesting that people like me, non-engineer, would read. So I get out of college and I don't know exactly what I want to do, but I know what I don't want to do. I know I don't want to write obituaries and be a stringer and cover, you know, city council meetings. It's just not appealing to me. So it being the, you know, late 90s, early 2000, I got a web job, you know, because if you could spell web, you could pretty much get a web job, I feel like, which worked out really well for me because I knew enough about design, you know, to talk my way into a web designer position at a company that made RC cars and RC planes in this weird little niche in Champaign-Urbana. So I helped design web pages first internally and then consumer facing of little RC cars. And, you know, I did a lot of design work and a lot of our stuff was kind of extreme. So being a small outfit, we had employees shot on the box art and things like that. So I showed up on a couple of RC car boxes, you know, with my
Where are those? I need to see that.
Oh, hopefully they're in a landfill somewhere.
I'm on eBay right after this interview, man.
But yeah, you know, and that was really interesting because right away I was like using design, you know, even though I was, you know, sort of sneaking my way into web design. And after that, I never really worked in web design after that, which is probably good for everybody because I'm not a web designer. I'm definitely not a developer. I was always very cognizant of what I did not know, which I felt like was everything in terms of design. So I was always trying to be very quiet about what I did not know and then learn everything I could. You know, in 2000, there weren't nearly as many design books, but I had them all, you know, because I was really insecure about what I didn't know. So I was always reading. I was reading things like, you know, Speak Up, Design Observer, these sort of Gen 1 design blogs, and understanding really how people thought about the work that they did. And I think that was always really interesting to me. And so there's always been a storytelling aspect to my flavor of design in a way that maybe other people who are very highly visual would think about it. And I've always tried to meld those things. But at different points, I would talk myself way past what I knew, and then I'd try to hurry up and catch up and learn what I could. And I spent 2 years there. And then me and two other guys had a little design shop because we didn't know anything. And we worked out of the back of what used to be an old skateboard shop on the back of a strip mall in Champaign-Urbana. And we had like five clients over 2.5 years. And we made enough money to, you know, eat and pay our rent and learned a lot. And it was this constant learning. And then I talked myself into my first actually design firm job, you know, in Chicagoland up in the suburbs. And then I learned a whole bunch there and learned this is how you kind of run a shop or this is how you don't run a shop. But this is how people talk about that work. I learned a lot about print and production back in the day when paper reps would come take you out to lunch. And, you know, I'd ask these people all these questions and I was always deeply aware of what I didn't know. So trying to carve out a place for myself. I was always the guy who was writing headlines and, you know, eventually doing strategy decks and doing the things that designers don't love to do, but maybe, you know, you can't always afford a copywriter. You know, I was always the poor man substitute because I have that writing background. So it was always this weird conglomeration of these couple of things and always trying to find this weird balance.
And sounds like you did a lot of learning at this agency, getting a sense for not how three dudes at the back of a skate shop run a studio, but how, you know, a proper studio is kind of organized at least. What events happened between that point and Hexanine? I learned about you when you were running that studio.
Yeah. So I worked at a design firm for a couple of years and it was really great. I learned a ton. And then when I felt like I kind of learned everything I was going to learn there, and maybe this is being a little too proud, but I felt like, oh, I kind of know what things I don't want to do. I started having this idea of how I would do this. I took another job in the city at another design firm that was mostly consumer packaging. You know, I sort of talked my way into that role, knowing almost nothing about package design. And I learned a lot there.
You had all those RC car packages with your face on them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's such a different thing. It was such a weird, like that industry was such a funny and strange subculture. But, you know, I had some vague senses of what made good packaging, but you know, that was really not my jam, you know, at least at that time. So I learned a lot here doing food packaging, you know, and then, you know, learned things like flavor profiles and, you know, demographics. And I learned a lot there. And then the big axe that fell was the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, and all the designers that I work with, we all got swept out. You know, you saw our clients disappearing each sort of passing month. And the big food company that was our main client really, really tightened their belts. So we all got let go. You know, it was a rough time. And so, you know, just out of necessity, I was like, okay, this is kind of, I feel like this is what it's been building to. I'm going to go out on my own. You know, some of it was pragmatic because there weren't a lot of jobs for me at that point. And also I, you know, I had been kicking around these ideas of how I would do things. So I'm, you know, by myself and I kind of reconnected with an old friend of mine who's a designer out in Los Angeles. And he was kind of found himself in a similar boat, but coming from the magazine world, you know, and if we thought it was rough on the consumer product side, magazine world, it was a bloodbath. And they would go through a series of bloodbaths later on. But, you know, that's what happened to him. And so we went from saying, hey, well, let's just keep in touch and, you know, talk every week or two, see how, you know, provide moral support as we freelance in that, to saying, hey, maybe we should try working together. And that was Hexanine. Basically, it was the two of us. And we had a couple of other people who came in and out as well. But we had sort of small offices in Los Angeles. And then I was here in Chicago. And, you know, that was almost 6 years. And I feel like I grew from actually thinking about how I wanted to do things to actually doing them that way. that was a time where I sort of figured out what I believed about a lot of this stuff.
And your focus was still print for the most part during that time?
Yeah, it was mostly print. We did a lot of identity work as well, you know, and it got pretty good at it, I think. Won some awards, you know, got published in some books like the Logo Lounge series, you know, and then I really started digging in and trying to understand strategy. You know, I'm trying to sell design strategy to clients and, you know, I know what I know, but I know it's not that much. So again, I'm in this place where I'm really trying to learn while also, you know, managing clients. And, but then also, you know, working for yourself, you get to do some of the things you want to do. So I did writing. We, you know, we had a blog and 95% of that was me musing about design and about the things that I was excited about. All that stuff basically led me into this whole next chapter, which was almost in some ways totally the same and in other ways completely different and a total departure.
I remember visiting your studio and being struck by the space and how much of it was committed to pop culture and these kinds of artifacts and all of the stuff that you cite as, you know, major influences for your own aesthetic and maximalism and all of this stuff. And just thinking like, how do you get any work done here? Like, it's just full of awesome toys. And it's like, so it felt like a museum space or something, you know, where it's like all of these things on display to kind of marvel at. And I thought, there's a lot of good raw material here. This guy's kind of, he's in the wrong thing if he's not making the most of this stuff instead.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I wish I were smarter and I could say, oh, well, you know, it was all part of this plan that I had to like dig into pop culture and embrace the things that I loved. But the honest answer is that it was kind of reflexive. You know, for most of the time, I didn't even have an office mate. So I just wanted to surround myself with the things that I liked, the things that visually inspired me, the things that from a storytelling perspective inspired me. So you've got Atari games and action figures and movie posters and all this stuff that, you know, visually is sort of the bread and butter, the things that I grew up with. And maybe if they didn't inspire me directly on a one-to-one visual basis, they definitely conceptually got me excited. So, you know, the start was I wanted to be in a cool, funky space. And it's funny because for a while I rented out part of the space to another guy who worked for himself. And eventually he left and he's like, yeah, I feel like I'm working in a toy store. And I'm like, hey, man, you know, it is what it is.
Like as a criticism or?
Yeah, it was a total criticism.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but you know, hey, that's fine. You know, and it was always that way. So it wasn't like a big surprise. But I think what it did is I was slowly sort of shedding a little bit of this really pragmatic upbringing, this very conventional way of thinking of like, hey, focus on the business. And I've sort of like giving myself permission to be more interested in those things, you know, and to sort of revisit them and to see if how those might influence me. You know, we did some work in the video game industry. We did, you know, some interesting things like that. Did some art books, but it wasn't something, you know, that like, that's what we're going to be. I mean, we did corporate communications, you know, we worked for the YMCA of the USA. We did identity projects for, you know, these big companies that are as far away from that stuff as you could get. But I wrote a blog post, you know, I think this is like 2012. You know, I was always trying to think about how do I tie the things that I'm interested in and tie it to the things that we do for, you know, big companies or corporations and all that. And so I wrote a blog post like, okay, you know, a handful of designers that I was thankful for. So it was everything from Sid Mead, who did a lot of the concepts for Tron, the original Tron, or David Carson was one of those. But another was the artist who did the Atari artwork, you know, and I knew some of their names barely. You know, one was Cliff Spahn, who did like 19 of the first Atari 2600 box art illustrations. And I, you know, I called him out specifically because I at least knew his name. I didn't know anything about him. And, you know, put that blog post up there, you know, it was fun. It's still, you know, floating out there somewhere. And I, you know, maybe a year later or something, somebody commented on this blog post. A woman who said, hey, this is super cool because I grew up next door to Cliff. You know, would you be interested in talking to him? I could connect you. And I was just like, what? This is crazy. You know, and I was like, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those sort of like internet kind of things, you know, like you put something out there and like it comes back to you. She found this. She connected me with Cliff, who, you know, now at this point, you know, his work on Atari was, you know, 25, 30 years in the rearview mirror. but you know, she passed along his phone number. He was willing to talk to me, and we had an almost a 2-hour conversation. And I was just asking him about the different pieces of art, you know, what he was thinking, what interested him. And I was taking some notes because I was curious, and you know, that art had really meant a lot to me, like both growing up, but then even later as I realized there was such a thing as illustration. And I remember just having this unbelievable conversation. I had filled like pages of notes, you know, in this yellow pad. And I remember hanging up, putting my phone down and thinking, I was like, wow, that was an amazing conversation. And if there are other people who remember the kinds of things that Cliff remembered, there's a book here. I could almost write a book.
So 2012, this is right around when your daughter was born, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. So think back to how all that started. What was it like when you found out that you were having a kid?
I mean, it was exciting and super stressful. We wanted kids. We were excited to have kids. But when we would talk about the time, my wife would be like, let's do it now. And I'm always like, let's do it later. Whatever time it was always later, you know, and that's not a plan. You know, I just like, I don't know anything about this. This is super scary, like responsible for somebody's life. Like, I'm not ready for that, you know, and I never felt ready. And I still don't feel ready as a dad. Well, maybe slightly more ready. I feel like I can have my kids and they won't die. You know, I can like take care of their basic needs. Right. But, you know, it was always like, wow, okay, we're doing this. And then it becomes super real. And then you're like, oh, I have a kid on the way. And you can feel the conventional, traditional stuff roaring back in my head. You know, eventually that forced me to realize, okay, is this working the way my family needs it to be working? You know, and ultimately, I think those kind of questions led us to being like, okay, you know, it's time to close the doors on this after, you know, almost 6 years. Both of us wanted to do different kind of work. But also I realized like, okay, I have one little kid and I'm pretty sure I'm going to have another. And I need to think about that. Hmm.
So you knew at some point earlier in your life that you wanted a family and children. That was always there?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think, you know, I would say in the abstract, you know, I think when you say you want kids, I don't think you really know, well, I'll speak for myself. I don't think I really knew what that would actually look like, but I did. I like kids. You know, I come from a good sized family. I have three younger brothers. There's four of us. I think for years, none of us actually had our own individual names. We were just like the Lapatino boys. So I didn't want four kids, but I knew, you know, I wanted kids. I feel like some people have like this whole plan. You're like, I want 2.5 kids and I want them 7 years apart. And, you know, I want them to be one of this and one of that. I mean, I didn't have any plan like that. But, you know, I was excited to have a kid, even though I felt like I probably didn't know exactly what that meant.
And what do you think made it easier for Emily, for your wife, to embrace this idea? You know, you characterize it as like, well, then let's start now. Let's start trying and let's have a kid now. And you feeling like, yeah, how about later?
It feels like there's a little bit of this cultural life plan. Like there are the things that you do, you know, and I think you see friends who are having kids and families and, you know, biological clocks and all that kind of stuff. There's some pressure there. Be like, what is everybody else doing? You know, and I think I was just sort of blissfully unaware. You know, but I also think as in general, guys like are spared a lot of that. It can be easy for us to just be unaware of some of that stuff. Whereas I feel like there's a whole subculture of evaluating and judging and comparing and, you know, one woman's judging another woman like, oh, they're doing that? What are they doing that for? I don't think you get quite as much of that, you know, if you're a guy, or at least maybe you're just, maybe I was just ignorant of it. So I, you know, there wasn't any external pressure for me to be like, oh, now's the time to have a kid.
Yeah. You got 9 months to make some decisions. You learn you're having a kid and you're concluding time at Hex and Nine, or at least thinking about what comes after that. And so walk me through that time and how would you characterize the emotions as you sort of sorted out the next thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big one is like fear, like, you know, abject fear, you know, like, oh, am I actually going to be a good dad? Like, I don't know anything about this. You know, I had a dad, I was raised by parents, but that was sort of the extent of my knowledge of it. And, you know, so you've got that on one hand, right? And I think it's just like the holy crap, I'm going to be a parent, I'm going to be responsible for someone. I'm really glad I've married a responsible woman. You know, that made me feel even better about that choice. And then the other hand is like, you know, I'm trying to run a business. And, you know, we've been doing Hexanine for about 3 years at that point. And everything else after that was like, okay, how do you evaluate this? I think we had a couple of good years in the middle there. So I was just thinking about keeping it rolling, you know, and saying, okay, we're finally getting some momentum here. When Paige was born, things were going pretty well. But it's this sustainability question of just getting the work and then doing the work. You know, you have these little celebrations in your mind saying, yes, I landed this project. And then like immediately falling, that's like, oh crap, now we got to do all this work, you know, and, you know, and you oscillate between the two things. Like, okay, in a vacuum, I love doing the work. In a vacuum, I love pitching the work. I love getting up in front of clients and, you know, prospects and calling people and be like, hey, let me convince you why you need to work with us. But, you know, the 1-2 punch of it, you know, I just keep getting hit in the face, you know, and it was, for me, it was really exhausting. Then you put that right next to having a little kid. I mean, I took a couple of weeks off to be with Emily and Paige, you know, when she was born. And then I went right back to it. And I remember sometimes being like, I think I might just need to put a bucket of ice water, like under my desk, you know, to put my feet in it to keep me awake, you know, because I mean, you're just so tired and you're so bleary eyed and everything sort of feels ethereal and out of focus when you're dealing with that little sleep and that being like, oh my gosh, what just happened here? You know, this baby just upended the world. All that stuff comes crashing down and it's a lot, you know, and I think people don't say this, but I, you know, my firm belief that running a business, running a small business, you know, whether it's design firm or whatever, it's a family thing. You can't help but have your family be involved in it, you know, and for good and for bad. So, you know, you celebrate when you land the big job and, you know, when something doesn't go well, you take that home, you know, you're like, okay, what does this mean for Q3? I think it was about the end of 2014 where we were both ready to fold up the tents, you know, and it wasn't like, oh, this is a terrible thing. It was, I think we just felt like it was time. We were ready to work by ourselves, work separately, do something different. You know, for me, it felt a little bit like a hamster wheel and we just weren't making the money that I wanted to make. So I was ready to give up that freedom of calling my shots, keeping my hours, going after the clients I wanted to go after and trade that up. You know, I just felt like, okay, for this next stage of life, I needed somebody else to run some of that stuff, you know, and I needed to go somewhere where there was some more stability and I could still do the things that I'm good at.
Yeah. That's an interesting point of awareness and reflection and trade-off, sacrifice, however you want to characterize it. And talking about your parents and the things they underscored at the beginning, stability and a paycheck. And yet here you were kind of looking down the barrel of that choice to say, okay, even if this isn't forever, I feel the need to recommit myself to something that feels more steady or feels like, you know, the administrative and operational side of running a studio is in someone else's hands and I can just do great work and kind of shift my focus. Is that fair characterization?
Yeah. And I think some people are like, oh, are you sad? Do you miss it? You know, and for a while, I think my answer was, well, no, I absolutely don't miss it because it's like a weight off my shoulders a little bit. But the other side was I didn't really think that this would be the end of that story. You know, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be a company man now, you know, and that's how I'm going to do it for the rest of my life. I mean, I think I don't think that's realistic, you know, in the work that we do anymore. I just don't see that happening. But that would have been a really discouraging thought for me. So, you know, I tend to look at things as like, okay, what's the next step? You know, and maybe I have a larger, big plan, but I feel like you can miss opportunities if you have this, well, eventually I just want to do this and there's where my bliss is, instead of being like, what's the thing that's right in front of me? Focus on the next thing. I feel like that's way healthier, you know, and for me, at least I can say that like has helped me deal with things and seeing, hey, this is a season of life. And what's the next season look like? Then looking back, you can write that story. You can write your hero's journey, you know, in retrospect and say, well, if I wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't have known this. And if that wouldn't have happened, this would have never happened. But you can't, good luck planning that stuff.
Yeah. I'm glad you're talking about this in terms of seasons of life. You used that phrase a few times. That's the same phrase that my therapist uses. And I find it really helpful that these decisions that we're making in terms of family and career, they're not life sentences or they're not permanent. We're not talking about forever time spans. We're talking about this time span, you know, and it's bound and it has some foreseeable endpoint or transition. And that makes spending time in it not crazy making, because we know that it is for a period of time, and then there'll be, like you said, new next steps or some other point. And I think for me, I have this very fatalistic look at everything. You know, like everything's like, oh God, like that's going to be forever. And I don't, it's helpful to hear you say it. And I think people need more of a reminder that it's like, no, this is what we're doing for now. And we're going to make the most of it, and it's going to be good for now. And there's another thing around the corner, and I can take comfort in that and not bug out in the near term or short term.
Totally, totally. And I think, you know, it sounds cheesy and it's almost cliche to be like, oh, I want to be present in this moment. But I feel like if you're so focused on like, I'm not getting to my goal, my end goal is 100 miles that way, and this is not getting me there, I think you miss all the things that are right in front of you. And I think some of those are the opportunities in disguise that will eventually get you there. But you don't know that at the time. But if you're so focused on complaining and being frustrated at the situation and just having this existential angst about it, I think you miss those things. And I can look back now in retrospect, you know, even in the last 10 years, I can see, you know, three or four of those things that completely changed, you know, the course of my career. You know, if I wasn't aware, if I wasn't available, if I wasn't pursuing these different things because I was sort of a little bit more in the moment, like I might still be stuck somewhere else.
And so this choice to go back to agency life or studio life and let go of some of the things that come with running your own studio so you can focus and maybe reprioritize some things, you know, around family and work. And that's also, I feel like, afforded you some bit where you could focus on Art of Atari and take that legal pad full of notes from that conversation and really begin to build something. Am I getting the timing right?
Pretty much. I mean, I think it's really interesting because I was thinking, oh, I'm going to have some security. Things are going to calm down. I got a new job. It was, you know, the farthest up the ladder that I had ever been. And I was like, okay, this is great. I'm just about to, you know, have another kid. You know, I can see a few years of stability and peace here as we sort of adjust to having two kids. But the timing was really interesting because it was right about the time when I basically was about ready to sign a book contract for Atari. You know, so in the background, I'm working on this book on and off for a couple of years, trying to land a publisher, trying to get a licensing deal, and those things really weren't working for me. You know, but this is happening in the background because I'm working for myself. That's, you know, 2012, 2013, 2014, and it all came together very quickly with a publisher. And I found myself not working full time. I was working like 2/3 time, you know, freelancing. And I actually had time to do this. And I needed it because we went from like 0 to 60 on this book and we went super fast. And I don't know how I would have done it with two small kids and a full time job, you know, and, you know, kept me and my wife sane. I don't think it would have happened. So it happened exactly how it had to happen, which was, you know, huge blessing, I feel like, because I don't know how I would have completed it. And that was, you know, it was like a passion project. It was something I'd wanted to do. And I was able to do it kind of how I wanted to do it. But it also had to happen in like 6 months, which is crazy. Like people don't write and design, you know, and curate a book in 6 months. I've been working on it in the background, you know, for a couple of years. But that's a different thing than let's have a book and production files sent to the printer. So I was able to squeeze it in there because I was working part-time and it was, you know, it was a sacrifice. And my wife is happy to talk about that part of it because she really carried a big chunk of the load while I did that. And that was, you know, for her, I don't think it was ever any choice. She's like, I know you want to do this. I know you love this. You're super excited about it. So we'll sacrifice to make it happen. And we did, you know, and it wasn't because it was like financially going to be some gigantic windfall, but it was because I really wanted to do this thing. And I was super passionate about it. And it was a really cool opportunity to put something out there into the world that I had never done before and I had never seen.
In that period of time, when you say she took on more, like what aspects did she take on so that you had space to do this?
I mean, it was all of it. I mean, it was like, it was the kids. You know, my wife's a therapist. She works full-time hours, but she squeezes into fewer days. So she was still busting her butt and working on stuff and doing as much as she could and freeing me up to disappear in the evenings and, you know, often weekends where I would just be writing and even my head would just not be in the game. I'd be like texting about that spread and what are we doing with this? And this person's calling me back to follow-up interview. So I, you know, my head was not 100% in the game you know, all the time. And I was working and I was doing this and squeezing it into every free minute because that was it. You know, that was all I had. And signing a contract at the beginning of 2016, I came in having a deadline. I knew what the deadline was. It was July. That thing wasn't going to move. So, I mean, we kind of went into a crazy mode. And I got to be sensitive when I say this. It was insane. And it was absolutely the best thing ever. I loved it. This was something that had totally fused all of the things that I was into, right? You know, I was writing, I was art directing this, I was curating it, I was retouching stuff, I was interviewing people. I had a design vision in mind for this thing. I had a way of thinking about it and a storytelling aspect of it. I had the freedom to do basically what I want to do. They said, hey, deliver us a book. We trust you. And it was amazing. And, you know, and so I own that book, you know, all the good, all, you know, all the warts that it also has, you know, things I would do differently now. But it was intoxicating. It was like, I have never done a project like this to this scale and scope where, yes, this was actually going out into the world. This was like the world's most amazing personal project, but it also just happened to be getting, you know, 75,000 copies printed as well.
What you just described is, I think, what a lot of people are chasing, you know, a chance to combine passion with skill and vision and, yeah, you know, not go broke making a purely passion project, but to actually put something out in the world, be recognized and supported by a publisher or someone else who's helping make it happen. And all of that sounds amazing. And then you factor in like two small humans and a partner who's really picking up the slack or, you know, doing a lot to make that possible. That it's in that quick paragraph that like all of it is made possible.
There's a lot under that, right? There's a lot of details. And I think if I were to do this again, I think I would have done a lot more asking than I did. I mean, I love my wife and she is so awesome. And she understood the opportunity here. Like, when do you get an opportunity like this? It's not an ideal situation for anybody, but we would never say no to this. She's so great that I think I took for granted how I'm like, all right, I'm doing this. Cool, right? Is it good? All right, let's go. Instead of being like, hey, I really appreciate everything you're doing and what you're going to have to do leading up to this. You know, and I think that we'll learn some lessons in our marriage about this. I learned some lessons, I'll say. And I think I would do more asking if I were to do it again. But I think for our family, I think it was like, well, yes, you've got this amazing opportunity. You know, it's sort of been dropped in your lap, but you've also been prepping for this for years. You know, we're going to do whatever it takes to make it happen. You know, and that was sort of our family thing. Now, it's not without its costs. You know, I think if you would have asked Emily on the day after those files went to the printer, hey, what do you think about Tim doing another book? She's like, I don't want to hear the word book.
Yeah, I bet. I'm curious, how do your kids play a role in these endeavors or do they?
I think a big part of making some of the decisions that I'm making in my professional life is I want my kids to see me doing it in real time. And I want them to see us taking risks as a family. And I want them to see us not being a slave to being comfortable, you know, whether that's professionally or even financially. You know, the idea that there are bigger things out there. You know, I feel like this is different than the way I was raised. And I don't know what are my kids going to be like knowing that mom's a small business owner, dad, you know, does these weird, crazy projects on the side and sometimes full time. You know, is the universe more a bigger, more open, expansive place for them in terms of opportunities after seeing that? Or maybe they're both going to become lawyers and, you know, and they're going to be like, that was such a crazy, uncertain childhood. I just want stability. I don't know. But I'm hoping that it's the first one. I'm hoping that it's, yeah, dad just writes books, you know, and he does crazy stuff with, you know, Star Wars and He-Man and Spider-Man and, you know, Pac-Man. And that's something I could do too. I want to tell a story to them as, you know, in little bits and pieces that your job can be fun. Sure, it's work, but you can do things you're passionate about and create.
What are some of the intentional things you do to foster your kids' creativity or at least give them opportunities to express themselves?
Yeah, I think some of it is just, I want my kids to do things more than be entertained, you know, and I'm guilty like any parent of like, hey, you know what? I just need a half an hour quiet, you know, go watch some cartoons, you know, or TV or something. But also like I have a home office. The things that I do my work with are out in the open for them to see. You know, we have a decent library here. All of my books, you know, they're not hidden away in some place. They're where the kids can see them and I'll pull the books down and we'll look at them together. They're into that stuff and I try and meet them where they're at, you know, and the stuff that they're interested in, but also share the stuff that I'm excited about, you know, whether it's the professional stuff like Atari or it's, you know, the passion stuff. Hey, I'm into Tron, you know, they're like, you've got Tron stuff on your desk, Dad. That's cool. I just want to show them that like, this is what it looks like when you're doing things that you're passionate about.
How has your creative practice evolved or adapted since having children?
It forces you to work faster. I don't think I'm not a fast worker. I like things to percolate for me and, you know, much to the chagrin of other people. So I need time, but then once I figure it out, then I can go fast. But I think for me, it's like, I'm that totally lame guy. People are like, hey, did you see Game of Thrones? Did you watch Black Mirror? What do you think about this new show? And I'm like, guys, I don't watch TV, not because I'm better than that, but because it's like, I have a choice. I can either, you know, sit down and plop in front of Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime, or I can put in an hour and a half, you know, 2 hours from, you know, 9 to 11 at night and do the thing that I know I need to do to move the ball forward.
Yeah. Yeah. As you think about these projects you've lined up and ideas for new books and the video game museum and other ideas, and also your kids are getting older. Describe the ideal state for evenness in your making and parenting. Like, what does that balance look like?
I think the balance is responsibility, you know, for my family and making sure that we're reasonably taken care of. I think we can have a whole side discussion about what does that actually look like. I think we need a lot more than we actually do. You know, I think we compare ourselves to other people and, you know, we look at all we have. And then, you know, I think sometimes we're measuring the wrong things. But I think the combination of making sure that there's a reasonable amount of security and also taking some risks, you know, and doing it together as a family, you know, and realizing, hey, you know what? We're going to combine this vacation with a work trip because Dad wants to interview the guy who designed the MTV logo. We haven't done that yet, but it might be on the docket.
I was going to say, that sounds like a real thing. Is that
only in my mind, but we'll see. It may be a real thing sometime soon, you know? And I think you got to just realize it's a humble, you know, and we do the same thing with my wife's work. Our family prioritizes her work, you know? So we're moving things around to make it that way. And it's the same rubric for me. It's the same criteria that she's passionate about it and she's really good at it. You know, and so it's like we're going to make decisions and we're going to make choices as a family to make sure that we can support both of those things. You know, and what does that look like? You know, does it look like, you know, like your awesome sabbatical that you're taking? Like, that's super cool. And like, that's a family decision, like a strategic choice. And I like those things and being able to sort of weigh that instead of just going along with the current and say, you know what, guys, this is how you do it. You get a job, put your head down, stay there. If you hate it, that's okay. You can always, you know, grill out in the back and watch Netflix, you know, cut the grass, and then, you know, dream of the day when you're going to be able to retire and, you know, go golfing and playing tennis. I don't know about you, but like for me, that sounds like the expectation of our culture. And I can't speak for anybody else, but I hate golf. Yeah, and I want to think about another way, you know, and it's really countercultural. I think all the things you're talking about are super countercultural, and you got to be, you know, not to put too fine a point on it. I don't know, brave's the right word, but I think you've got to be willing to stand against the current and have people think you're a moron, you know, be like, why would you do that? Why would you leave that good job? Why would you, you know, take that chance? Why would you do this thing? You know, you gotta know what you believe, right? You gotta know what's important to you as an individual, as a professional, and as a family. Because otherwise you can't make that choice. You're just gonna get pulled along by the current and end up comparing yourself to everybody else and doing things that way.
Yeah. That's a good perspective that I don't think we hear enough about. Or if we do, it's in some weird, like, live your best life aphorism on Instagram which you're like, yeah, but how, you know, or like,
right.
Sure. But like, that sounds like I might go into debt doing that or you know, whatever. Like for me, I read that. I'm like, oh, cool. That's a positive thought. And then my panicky freak out brain is like, yeah, but that's not real life. Like you can't just do that.
Yeah.
You know, even now,
yeah.
Taking a year off on one hand feels like, you know, an incredibly irresponsible thing to do, considering just life and the fact that I've got a mortgage and kids in school that cost more than my mortgage. And
yep.
It feels really dumb. Like I know that there are people that are like, man, that guy is making a huge mistake. And then on the other hand, it's to your earlier point, like it's exactly what I need to do to set an example, because one day my son or daughter will be in a position to take a risk or explore something. And I want them to have the very real, tangible example of Maris and I as reference and not some imaginary live your best life statement on Instagram as a point of reference.
Right. And I think the difference is like live your best life. That's not a plan, you know, but instead you made a decision as a family, you know, and you're strategic about it. Like, you know, I mean, that's a huge difference. Like, you know, then I don't think it's stupid. Then I think it's smart. You know, it's like you're counting the cost, you know, and I think sometimes people conflate following your passion with being an idiot. That Venn diagram doesn't have to intersect. But, you know, you swap around a handful of those decisions and suddenly that big decision that you just made, like it's in reach.
Thanks for making me feel better about it.
Well, and I look at the people who have, you know, all the things that I want, or what, quote unquote, right? You know, and, you know, the people who like, okay, you know, I sold my company and made all this money, you know, we had our IPO. Are they demonstrably happier than I am? You know, are they just like, you know, sunbeams, you know, just flow from them and, you know, they walk on rainbows? No. So, you start from there, you know, and I think then, you know, it makes you think about, okay, what actually is important, you know, but again, it's counterculture. And I think you've got to make those decisions for yourself. You know, like, what does this look like? What are we trading this for that? And I don't think it's all about my personal happiness. I think there's a distinction between joy and happiness. I think you got to make.
That's right. There's all of this that's built up around being a man and a husband and then maybe, or maybe not, a father. And the narrative around that feels like when you have a kid, all the plans that you had as an individual doing things in the world are like on pause or maybe never even are realized. Children are time thieves, you know?
Yeah.
And so like, you know, resentment, frustration, defensiveness around time for me has flared up in all kinds of ways I'm not proud of. And part of this sabbatical is to reflect on that and figure out, you know, how do I arrive at a better balance where I am still pursuing these creative things with passion and excitement and still taking care of my family and co-parenting in ways I'm proud of. And like, how do I dad well and still explore creativity and not just punch a clock at an agency or something?
Yeah, totally. I don't know how much I've learned, but I think one thing I do know is that if you come in looking at kids like, you know, what they cost versus, you know, what they give you. I mean, I think that, you know, if you're going to make a financial projection kind of thing, it's like the net benefit of having kids is amazing. Like they're awesome and they're fun and they're inspiring and they're hilarious. And they challenge me to think about things differently, you know, and they're such a joy and they're so funny. And then there's the other side, right? They're hard and they're exhausting. At times I'm like, why am I so tired? Oh, wait, I have two children. Everything else being equal, I'm still exhausted. But part of this is that countercultural thing of, you know, it's all about me. You know, it's not all about you. It's about the family, you know? So if dad's having a hard time and you need some time for yourself, it's like, how do we make that happen as a family? If, you know, you don't have time for your side projects, why is that? It's not automatically kids. You know, kids go to bed early. You know, what do you do after that? What are you not doing? You know, do my kids need to be in 12 activities? You know, I have parent friends who are like, I don't do any of that stuff anymore because I'm chauffeur. I'm like, do your kids need to be in 5 sports and 2 after school activities? You know, I think that's the cultural wind. I think that's what people tell us is being a good parent, but I think you got to decide it for yourself, you know, because maybe the way my family operates better is we do less activities. We don't sign up for a million things, but we do a couple and then we do the other things together. You know, I think we got to look at it that way. You know, I don't think all, and again, this is me and this is, I feel a rant coming on, but I feel like we can over program and over, structure, you know, our children's lives. And I think we've lost something about the idea that like families did things together, you know, 100 years ago, maybe it was everybody worked on the farm together, whether it was their bliss or not, you know, this is what the family did together, you know, and nobody complained about it because that's just what you did, you know, and maybe there's more of that. Maybe it's like, hey, you know, dad's an illustrator, you know, so part of what we do as a family is we go to art museums or we, you know, do this thing or that thing. Like we can do it all together, you know, just because it's not packaged for audiences 7 and under and the thing that all of their friends are doing doesn't mean it's the wrong thing, you know?
Yeah, that's helpful. I feel like in the worlds that we are in, creative and expressive, there's even more reason to bring a kid into it because children are born with all of that and society and school and friends and outside influences kind of mush that out of people. But I think inherently kids make stuff, you know, they combine different things together to produce new results, just being exploratory. And I think that being artists or designers or DJs or, you know, musicians, writers, we somehow manage to get to adulthood and not have that crushed or subverted. Yeah. And I think what you're describing, this idea of bringing them along and folding them into our worlds rather than giving up everything and conforming to what other people say are appropriate activities or ideas for kids, I think that's awesome and not something that's widely encouraged or considered, especially if you sit outside of the creative industry. I think that's in ways unique to us.
If there's a place to marshal some creativity, I think it's in raising kids. You know, like, why do we do the thing that everybody else does? Or why do we do the things that our parents did? I mean, I think it's on us, you know, quote unquote, professional creative or not, to pull out some creativity and be like, what are the wild things that you can do? You know, do you go to the flavor of the month kids museum where everything is, you know, absolutely step one, step two, step three, step four? Or do you decide, hey guys, you know what, we're going to go to this rinky dink little arcade, you know, that's tucked away in a strip mall, and we're going to play a game that you've never seen before, you know? Or are you going to help me organize this thing? You know, what are we going to do? You know, what are we going to do together? I feel like if kids are raised with parents who have killed their hearts and have subsumed all of their interests and desires in the interest of being quote unquote responsible, what kind of kid are you raising? Is that the definition of responsible? Are those the kids who are going to, you know, solve the world's problems? Are those the kids who are going to be healthy, happy, and well-adjusted? Because the end result is to get a job? Or is it to be like a three-dimensional human being who has interests, who has passions, who is like curious about the world? That's what we say we want. But are we backing that up with the way we raise them and the thing that we're showing them in the way we act? I think that's a question every parent's got to ask.
Yeah. Kids are so great at modeling behavior. It just comes natural. Like whatever they see, they mimic, and you know, they're still learning themselves. And in doing that, they take their own shape. And so one of the things, because they're so susceptible to mimicry, I think you're right in the positioning of the things that we're trying to do that feel different than the mainstream path as normal to our kids plant some kind of seed that I believe we're hoping grows with them where they don't have to conform, and whether they're artists or designers or musicians or not, they can at least tap into that and think differently about the world.
Totally. And I think you talked about, you know, the idea of risking and solving those problems. I mean, we're in a place of privilege, you know, there's no denying it. Like, you know, like I'm not worried about where the next meal is coming from, and that's huge. Like, and I feel really blessed by that. But I also think there's a responsibility. You know, if I have that, I should do some things with it. So I think of like doing risky things, quote unquote. I'd like to look at this, and I'm a positive person, so maybe this is not good for other people. It's like, what's the worst thing? You know, how could this blow up in my face? What's the absolute worst thing that's going to happen if I did this? Could we recover from that? You know, I try to write this book and it fails, or, you know, I take this new job and it sucks, you know, or I quit that job and, you know, the other one doesn't materialize. Is that a spiral that's going to flush my life down the toilet? Probably not, you know, and I'll probably learn some things from it. You know, I mean, you got to go in eyes wide open, but I like to look at it. It's like, you know, I think we fear the risk and the failure. And I feel like rarely are those things are the things that are going to crush us as people. You know, whereas the upsides are so great. You know, I think when you look at it like that, you know, we have some opportunities of being who we are and in the positions that we're in, I think you're kind of crazy not to take a few risks.
You're right. That is true. Any other advice you have for the creative guy who's about to become a dad and everyone's telling him his life is over, or is maybe even wondering if kids plus this bucket list of creative achievements can be reconciled. What do you say?
I mean, I would say, first of all, give yourself grace. On one hand, it's true. You're never going to go back to having all the time that you had. You're only going to have probably less for, you know, 18 years at least. And that's okay. And come to terms with that. Grieve it if you need to. Then move on, you know, and give yourself some grace. There's times when you're like, I'm super tired. I'm not going to do anything tonight. And that's okay. I can go and watch stupid reruns or something because my brain and body just need a break. And that's fine, you know. But then the other side is like, okay, now you have an awesome opportunity to see how creative you are and how bad do you want it? You know, because it's one thing to separate it. It's like, you know, a hobby that's kind of fun versus something I'm passionate about it and I need this like for my own health, creativity, and sanity. If you really need it, you will find a way to make it happen. You know, whether it's at night when the kids go to bed or it's, you know, instead of zoning out and reading Facebook on the train, maybe, you know, you're working on it. Somebody was telling me the other day they saw somebody editing a podcast on the train. And I was like, if they were a stock, I would invest, you know, because that's somebody who's going somewhere, right? Because that's how much they care about what they're doing and they're going to squeeze every moment out of it. That's awesome. I was like, dude, I'm inspired, you know, and I think I would never tell someone, no, you know, follow your passion and it'll all work out. I don't think that's responsible advice, but I would also say, you know, don't let your passion die. You know, don't kill your heart in a way. I'd say do, you know, find a way to do the things that you care about and you're good at. And it goes places. Now, it doesn't mean like sell the car, you know, sell the house, you know, sink all the money into this. I mean, I don't think that's responsible, but I do think there are ways to do this stuff, you know, whether it starts as a side hustle or, you know, it's a small thing that you just do on the margins to keep yourself sane. I think it's crazy. And I think you'd be surprised that people respond to passion. I think they connect with somebody talking about the things that you know, are interesting and make a difference to them.
Tim, thanks so much.
Hey, it's my pleasure, man. Thank you. I feel like this is awesome and therapeutic. I feel like I just got out of therapy.
I'm sure I'm nowhere as good as Emily, but I appreciate that, man. Thank you for being honest, for sharing how you arrived here and all the things along the way. I've heard you talk about the book and you focus on the research and investigation and these great conversations and the creative process, and you acknowledge your wife and your family always. I've heard you do that, but to really dig in and spend a little more time on the behind the scenes, I think is important for people to hear, because you could look from the outside and just marvel at how someone puts an entire book together in 6 months and it's so successful and you're speaking at C2E2 and traveling and not really recognize the effort or the trade-offs or the real impact of things. And I think that's really special to be able to give that to other people who are wondering themselves, like how they pull that off, myself included.
Well, thanks. I mean, hopefully it's super encouraging, because if like a dummy like me can do it, I mean, come on. I mean, guys, it's there for the taking.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a review on iTunes. As a new podcast, this helps a ton and would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of those. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter, check out some helpful resources and books, and even cop some fresh Dadwell merchandise. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.